This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earth and climate scientists converged on San Francisco this week for the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union. But between discussions of new research in geology, it was hard to avoid the elephant in the room, the future of climate science under a Trump administration. Seems like it was all anyone could talk about. Joining me to discuss new events, new developments at this year's meeting, including this specter looming over climate science, is Lawrence Summer, science and environment reporter with KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Lauren, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks. Hi, Ira.
So the mood there at the AGU, not pleasant, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to many of these AGU conferences, and this wasn't like any of the others. I mean, the sense of anxiety and worry was really palpable. And among the people I spoke to, it just seems to come from this sense of uncertainty about, you know, what the role of science is going to be under a Trump administration. I mean, certainly in the last few weeks, we've seen the president-elect appoint a few cabinet members that either doubt or fully reject the scientific consensus about climate change. So a lot of concern from federal scientists about the future of their jobs, of funding, and they actually held a rally. They put on a small group, at least, of scientists put on some white lab coats and held a rally to stand up for science.
Wow, that's shades of the 60s. We have a clip of Governor Jerry Brown speaking to a room full of scientists at the meeting, talking about California launching its own satellite.
California will launch its own damn satellite. We're going to collect that data. We got the scientists, we got the universities, we have the national labs, and we have the political clout and sophistication for the battle. And we will persevere.
Lauren, what was that all about?
Yeah, the governor was responding to some comments that were made a few weeks ago by a senior advisor to President-elect Trump who said he thought NASA's mission should focus on deep space instead of the Earth. And what he's really talking about is this group of core satellites that capture a lot of the baseline climate data, like temperature, precipitation, you know, ice levels, things like that. And so he kind of said NASA's budget should be maybe cut to reflect that. What Governor Brown was saying is that if Washington backs off collecting basic science, and you know, these are core data sets for scientists, that California may step up to the plate here.
Wow. You also mentioned that some people are downloading climate science data sheets from government servers to protect them and the data in case something happens to them.
Yeah, this was really interesting. I mean, this started with a few tweets at the beginning of the week that I saw, and it's kind of morphed into its own mini movement. I mean, the concern, at least maybe in a precautionary way, these scientists are taking is that, you know, some of these data sets are government data sets, and they live on government servers, and they just want to maybe have some extra insurance that they don't go away. So there's going to be a hackathon at the University of Toronto this weekend where people are going to get together and start downloading some of these data sets. There's a few others planned for other universities. And if people want to follow the hashtag on Twitter for this, is hashtag data refuge.
Wow. Okay, let's move on to some other stuff that came out of the meeting. The Arctic Report Card, which was released this week. How did the Arctic do this year?
Yeah, not good. Maybe an F, I think. You know, for scientists, the Arctic really is the canary in the coal mine for climate change. And this year, scientists have seen things that they've never seen before. You know, really low levels of sea ice, among the lowest they've ever recorded. You know, average temperatures at their highest. And they're finding that the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the planet. So, you know, according to one scientist, he said the data before was saying that, you know, the Arctic was whispering that change was happening. And now the data is showing that the Arctic is shouting.
Wow. So there was a large degree shift in getting warmer?
Yeah. And, you know, this obviously has a lot of impacts for the people that live in the Arctic and the wildlife and the animals. But, you know, one thing they also talked about is it could affect people here in the U.S. And I guess I should ask, Ira, how's the weather in New York today?
It's pretty cold. It's Arctic-like in New York today. So
yeah, it's the polar vortex, right? You know,
it certainly feels
this area
like it.
This area of cold air that normally hangs out around the Arctic, it's kind of like lassoed in by the jet stream normally. That's why we don't feel it. And what happens is sometimes that jet stream weakens and then, you know, that lasso kind of starts to wobble and dip. And that's when you get this blast of cold air that dips down to the U.S. You know, one of the theories that scientists are working on is that with climate change and a warmer Arctic, that jet stream will get disrupted more, which could lead to more polar vortexes here in the United States.
What about what happens to the Arctic and environment itself, for people living there? Could it run away, this sort of system?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the people and communities, they're seeing permafrost melt that they never thought would really melt. And so you've got buildings and infrastructure that are now on unstable land. Certainly, with the loss of sea ice, there's kind of cascading effects on the food chain that scientists are really just starting to understand.
Mm-hmm. Let's go on to at least some lighter news about our favorite topics, the planets, about volcanoes on other planets and how they shape the planets.
Yeah, so... this is called polar wander. To use a seasonal example, if we can picture Santa's workshop maybe up at the North Pole, there are things that can happen to the surface of a planet, volcanoes and asteroid impacts, that actually change the way the mass is distributed on a planet, and it would cause Santa's workshop to drift away from the actual North Pole. On Venus and Mars, what scientists did is they kind of recreated how this has happened. On Venus and Mars, it's been because of big, big volcanoes. If you could imagine, there's a mega volcano erupting on Los Angeles, and this would be like two times or more the size of Mount Everest, it would cause Los Angeles over millions of years to shift to down towards the equator. And so this is kind of what's happened on Mars and Venus. And on the Moon and Mercury, it's been these big asteroid impacts that have actually changed the way that the planet, what's actually been at the North Pole of those planets.
So this is not something we have to worry about. It's just discovering how the planets are changing.
Well, our North Pole actually is moving. It's because Greenland, there was a ton of ice on it in the last ice age. And since that ice has gone down, Greenland is still lifting up very slightly. It's uplifting the crust there. And so actually our North Pole is very incrementally and slowly kind of moving toward Greenland. Not anything to worry about, though.
I can see the bumper sticker now. Greenland is uplifting. We'll put that down. Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for your great reporting. Lauren Sommer is science and environment reporter with KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. With Inauguration Day just around the corner, many scientists and engineers are wondering anxiously if the next administration will continue to pay for developments in clean energy research. Next year, though, the federal government won't be the only big funder in the game. Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and a group of mega-wealthy investors have come together to create the Breakthrough Energy Ventures Fund, and they're dedicating $1 billion to clean energy projects starting next year. So what could be the downside? Joining me to discuss the good and the bad of big investments in clean energy is my guest, Kevin Delaney, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Quartz. Kevin, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Can you give us a little idea again what Bill Gates is trying to do here?
Yeah, so Bill Gates just announced that along with some of the wealthiest people on the planet, that they've raised a $1 billion fund to invest in clean technology projects. So the core of what they're looking to do is to fund companies, actually. It's a for-profit venture that are building on research that has the potential to revolutionize how we get energy, and it needs to be clean and affordable and scalable. And those are their objectives. They're looking at some specific areas, so energy use in agriculture and in manufacturing and things like that. But the top line is that there's $1 billion that they're now going to invest in companies in this area.
Oh, that sounds like a good thing. Where could the bad news be here?
Well, I think it's a great thing, but the history of clean tech investment over the last decade or so has not been amazing. So there was a research study out of MIT earlier this year that found that venture capital funds invested over $25 billion in clean tech companies, clean tech startups, from 2006 to 2011, and the VC firms lost roughly half of that. So the history of investment in this specific type of project is not the first thing you'd run to put your retirement money in.
You know, but these guys in the room are smart guys. I mean, they must know that the risks are involved here, and what you're pointing out, the MIT study conclusion. So do you think they can do it better?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're smart guys. And almost more to the point, they're super wealthy guys. Just the board of directors of this fund has a net worth estimated at around $170 billion. And what they say is that their patience, because they're super wealthy, they don't need to get a return immediately, means that they're in their capital, which means that they can invest even more than $1 billion in projects that are promising and companies that are doing well, means that they're able to do what the VC firms were not actually able to do. They're able to invest the capital, which energy projects at scale can require. You imagine it takes a lot of money if you're building a nuclear plant or whatever the technology is to provide people with energy, clean energy at scale. And the fund has a 20-year lifespan, which is longer than your typical venture capitalist time horizon. And that means that they can wait for these things to play out. It's not like investing in an internet startup in Silicon Valley where you put $50 million in and within 2 years you know whether or not it's successful. These are categorically different types of projects. And what this group of investors led by Bill Gates argue is that, you know, they're probably the only ones who can really fill this gap.
But the MIT study that you cite says that there has to be cooperation with the federal government research centers, all these federally funded things. Can the new Donald Trump as president, if he decides he doesn't like this, you know, do something to railroad it out of existence?
It's a really good point. And in fact, Bill Gates and the investors in this fund have said that only governments can invest in the fundamental research and development of technology that is capable of making these breakthroughs in the energy area. And so they are piggybacking on government research and trying to get that commercialized. Gates was among those who led something called Mission Innovation last year, which 25 governments and the European Union signed on to. Now, the U.S., and what they agreed to was that they were going to double their R&D in energy.
Kevin,
over 5 years.
I got to go. We'll pick this up in a longer piece, which it deserves, and have you back, okay? Kevin
Great,
Delaney,
very much.
Co-founder and editor-in-chief of Quartz. After the break, we discuss sexual harassment for women in science. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this month, the American Museum of Natural History Human Origins curator, Brian Richmond, resigned from his job 10 months after Science Magazine reported he had been subject to multiple investigations regarding allegations that he sexually assaulted female subordinates at the museum and field research sites. Until resigning, Richmond had been banned from the museum, but he was working remotely and still drawing a salary. His case is only one of several to come to light recently. There's UC Berkeley astronomer Jeff Marcy, who stepped down from his faculty position at UC Berkeley last year after charges of harassment and inappropriate behavior with undergraduate students. There was Ebola researcher Michael Cates at the University of Washington, who allegedly paid one of his lab staff members for sex and sexually harassed another. And there are more. The conversation about sexual assault on women in science by their institutional superiors has been growing. Twitter hashtags like AstroSH and BioSH have continued that conversation on social media. So what's your take? Have you seen sexual harassment or worse in your field? Do you have some solutions to it? That's what we're going to be talking about. I want you to give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. Also, you can reach us on Twitter at SciFry. My guests are two reporters who have been covering stories like these, Azine Gureshi, science reporter at BuzzFeed News, and Michael Balter, now at Verge, who first broke the Richmond story for Science Magazine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, Brian Richmond is a story you broke in your reporting for Science. His isn't the first case of sexual assault in academia. What made that one noteworthy?
Okay, that's a really good question. The one thing I'd like to clarify is that Brian's resignation is effective December 31st, but the museum has announced it. So he's still working off-site and still the curator of Human Origins for about another 15 days. and then he will be gone from the museum. They'll have to find somebody else. It's a very interesting question you're asking, because when we were discussing at Science whether to actually cover this story or not, we had to ask ourselves that exact question: why cover this particular case when there were so many? I think that there's a couple of reasons, at least. One is that this had become a very big issue in the anthropology community that Brian Richmond was part of. It was kind of an open secret in that community, and people were trying to grapple with what to do about it. And so in a way, it was kind of a community story as well, looking at how scientists deal with this kind of situation, what they can possibly do about it. The other thing is that although I argue that how high profile a scientist is should not be a determining factor in whether we cover them or not, it was the case that Richmond was in a very high profile and public position as curator of human origins. Normally, he would be giving talks and doing the public outreach for human evolution for the entire American Museum. Mm-hmm. So I think that we felt that when you added those and some other factors together, that it was a story worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Azine, you reported on Jeff Marcy and Michael Cates, among others, both star researchers at the time of the investigation, yes?
Yes, I did.
Where do these men's cases currently stand?
Well, Jeff Marcy resigned in October of last year, shortly after his investigation at UC Berkeley came to light. Michael Cates, however, is still employed by the University of Washington. They have sort of a peer panel of professors who are deciding, you know, whether to terminate his position. His lab has been shut down, so you know, he's still drawing a salary, but the grant funded portion is no longer being given to him.
Yeah. What is the role of you as members of the media in reporting these stories if the institutions were already aware and disciplining these people?
Well, I mean, I can speak to the cases that I've covered. I think in the Marcy case, you know, these women had come forward after, you know, trying very many different sort of approaches, going to the department chair, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, and then had finally gone through the very taxing process of filing an official Title IX complaint, you know, getting all the complainants together. And at the end of all that, they, you know, got a letter from UC Berkeley saying that, you know, the investigator had found that Marcy had violated sexual harassment policies, but that essentially they weren't going to do much about it. They were very vague on the details, but it was pretty clear that they were not going to discipline him and that he was going to be able to keep his job and that no one would know about it. And I think that these women decided to come forward after feeling disappointed by the process as it exists.
System failed them.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah,
Michael,
exactly.
Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think in the two major cases that I've covered this year, the Brian Richmond case, and also very recently a story I did for The Verge about the case of Miguel Pinto at the Smithsonian Institution, in both cases, their institutions involved had no interest whatsoever in revealing them publicly or even internally. Both institutions did as much as they could to try to keep things quiet. I think to their credit that that's beginning to change, as a great deal has happened at the American Museum over the last year on the part of especially the Women in Science group there and other curators and faculty to try to make sure that this kind of thing can't happen again, or at least diminish the possibility.
Do you think that the women doing work in science suffering from sexual harassment are any different than women in any other professions? I mean, what is there unique about this?
I mean, I think a lot has been said about whether this problem is unique to science, and some prominent people have said that's not the case. But, you know, we're never going to have the numbers to settle that debate. The reality is that we have only seen probably the tip of the iceberg in terms of women who are brave enough to come forward about their experiences. But what we do know is that science, the way science works, especially at research institutions like UC Berkeley or University of Washington, it's set up differently than other workplaces. It's extremely hierarchical. These graduate students or undergrads are extremely dependent on their relationship to their PIs, who are in a great position of power. You know, they rely on them for data, for collaborations, for grants, for basically their whole career lies sort of in the balance of this relationship that has to be appropriate. And if it's not, it's the impetus is on the victim to really address that. And the institutions have mm-hmm. sort of a vested interest in keeping that quiet. Mm-hmm.
I want to turn now to Meg Urey, professor of physics and astronomy at Yale. She was the president of the American Astronomical Society when the story about UC Berkeley astronomer Marcy, a history of harassment, first broke. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
You were president of the AAS when one case, as I say, Jeff Marcy, came to light. What was your reaction as a leader in astronomy?
Yeah, well, it hadn't been something that was a major focus at that time, but I realized immediately we needed to respond that, you know, our professional society is a home for astronomers, and we need to support astronomers to help them thrive in their research. So we already had a pretty effective anti-harassment statement, which policy which works when we're, you know, in charge of a venue, like at a meeting, for example, a scientific meeting. But we needed, I realized pretty quickly, we needed to enhance our code of ethics to have be a statement of what is okay behavior and what is not okay behavior in the professional sphere. Mm-hmm. And we've done that now, and we are, we've talked a lot about this issue, both within our society and with other professional societies in science.
Dr. Urey, you've also been a woman working in astronomy for several decades. You have a large view picture of this. Has harassment of women by male scientists gotten worse since the beginning of your career?
No. I'm sure it's not any worse now than it was when I started. It might even be better, but it is very much a hidden problem. I mean, I'm grateful to Azine and Michael for bringing some of these stories to light. I think the problem is, as they've explained, that your career is so dependent on, you know, your mentors, that if one of them is harassing you, you complain about it at the risk of your career. I personally didn't know how pervasive this was. I thought it was terrible when it happened, but that perhaps it was rare. I'm not sure why I thought that, but maybe because we don't hear about many cases. But I've learned since the Marcy case broke, really, I've learned from young women in astronomy that there are, you know, lots of people who have encountered sexual harassment.
Yeah, in fact, we have a clip of one anthropologist, Dr. Meredith Righteous, describing the disbelief she faced when she reported being assaulted by an advisor during a field research trip.
Senior researchers and administrators came up with a variety of stories about what had happened. They said that I was either a lesbian or had already been sleeping with the senior researcher. I requested two things. I requested that they acknowledge that something had happened and that some remedial action be taken with the person who had approached me so inappropriately. But instead, they told me to apologize to the senior researcher for the distress that I had caused him by my unfounded accusations. I apologized. He did not accept the apology and withdrew from the project, leaving a gap where his expertise had been.
Wow. Dr. Urey, why aren't women believed when they report these experiences?
That's an amazing quote. A lot of us were kind of jolted by a similar study in 2014 by Kate Clancy, who's also an anthropologist, who looked into how scientists who do their research in the field, so they're away from home, you know, staying remotely somewhere else, how they encounter sexual harassment. And it was an extremely high fraction of both men and women. It's about 70% of men and 85% of women were reporting that they were harassed or assaulted. It was happening everywhere. The difference, men were typically approached by peers, and women were typically approached by superiors. So that was really, you know, it's really an eye-opener. And astronomers also go to, you know, we do our research at telescopes in many cases. So very similar stuff happening in our, you know, in the same way. I think you need the combination of two ingredients to have a sort of a high potential for this bad behavior. One is uneven numbers. So women are a pretty small fraction of many of the physical sciences, for example. And then the hierarchy that Azine mentioned, where, you know, somebody has a fair amount of power over their, you know, their graduate students or their postdocs.
Azine, what are the reforms you've seen proposed in the wake of these scandals?
Sure. I just wanted to point out one thing. I mean, in terms of women being believed, I think that's a problem that we see outside of science across the board in terms of these issues around sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape. And we're seeing that national conversation, you know, mm-hmm. really broaden in terms of figuring out why even police departments don't, you know, believe women when they come to them with rape cases, for example. But as far as what's being done, I mean, Meg addressed the professional societies, I think, have really taken on a lot of the responsibility in terms of, you know, a local approach to trying to address these problems and have sort of more checks, you know, if to sort of supplement what the universities are able to do. At a bigger level, I think, you know, we have Congresswoman Spear, Jackie Spear, who has introduced legislation requiring universities to disclose if PIs have been have had a sexual harassment complaint lodged against them, if there was an investigation, to provide that to grant funders. So at that's sort of taking a step, the step of accountability above the universities, holding them accountable in terms of, you know, whether they will receive research funding. And that's obviously been, you know, that was a huge factor in the conversations around Marcy and Cates, is they were bringing in tremendous amounts of money to their universities. And, you know, there were a lot of questions about whether there are incentives for universities to sort of let these things slide or look the other way or keep them quiet.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about women, harassment of women scientists in their own profession. Michael, did you want to jump in there to say anything?
Yes, I think that I certainly endorse everything that's been said so far. What I'm particularly interested in is the question of how the culture is going to eventually change. And the way I see it, we're going to have to go through a few stages here. And the first stage is clearly that there's going to have to be very severe consequences for people who are found guilty of doing this. So Jeff Marcy resigns, Brian Richmond resigns, in the case of the Smithsonian, somebody has been banned from ever going into the Smithsonian and doing their research there, which is quite a blow to that particular researcher. So I think that we're going to have, unfortunately, because careers are going to be ruined, and that's not necessarily happy, but a necessary step. And then from there, I think we might go to sort of internalization. In other words, if you do this, you're going to really be hurt by it. And if that's increasingly the case, then people will get that message. And then finally, and maybe it's going to take a generation, I hope not, but maybe, you know, in the next generation of researchers, that there will be the real kind of broad cultural change that we eventually need to see here.
Dr. Urey, where do you stand? What, do you agree with the future here, or do you have something else that you'd like to add?
No, yeah, I think these are this is the direction we have to go. There's two things I would add. One is just to mention Jackie Spire's bill also includes a clause that, well, first let me say that reporting a sexual misconduct to funding agencies would be right in line with what is currently required, which is that research integrity violations be reported to funding agencies. So it's a very similar, it's very parallel, but right now universities are essentially, you know, prohibited from reporting sexual misconduct information. So that would be a really positive major change. The other thing that's in there is independent funding for graduate students. That is, funding doesn't come directly from a principal investigator on a grant. They can, the funding goes directly to the student, and then the student can choose which group to work in, and that gives them some independence from this. You know, in some cases, if the harasser is paying your paycheck, you risk not only your career, but you know, your job, your health benefits, and everything else. So that's a concern. If I could just add one more thing, is I think we need very clear rules. And, you know, it's, we have Title IX, of course, but it's funny. I work in a university, and we have a very clear rule that no professor, any kind of teacher in the classroom, may date any undergraduate at the institution. And there are pretty strict rules about graduate students, although in recognition of their, you know, greater maturity, it's a little, it's just very slightly looser. So those rules are extremely clear, and people know what they mm-hmm. are, and they know not to violate them. 35 years ago, when I was a student, it was pretty routine for faculty to marry their students. That was just common behavior. And I think for a lot of people, you know, the change has caught up with them, and we just need to reiterate what our values are and what acceptable behavior is.
Got to say goodbye to Azine Gureishi of BuzzFeed News and Michael Balter for The Verge. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to come back after the break and continue our discussion of extra hurdles women face in scientific careers. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We were just talking about the new attention being drawn to sexual assault and harassment of female researchers, and what it might take to ensure that women can embark on scientific careers free of unwanted attention from men who have control over their success. But what about other inequities that might be holding back their careers? Women are getting a larger proportion of science PhDs than ever, yet they remain a minority of tenured faculty. What's the problem? Is the glass ceiling any tougher in the glass laboratory? We've been talking with Meg Urey, professor of astronomy and physics at Yale, past president of the American Astronomical Society. And I want to bring in two others who have been closely scrutinizing equity and opportunity for women in science. Cassidy Sojimoto is an associate professor of informatics at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And Kuhaley Dutt is assistant director of academic affairs and diversity at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. She is also co-author of the book Women in the Geosciences. But I want to welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on the show.
You're welcome. Let me begin with you, Dr. Urey. How has the climate for women in science changed since you started? You said it was a lot worse. Feels like it's getting better a little bit.
Yeah, there's a big difference from when I was a student. I'm quite old now. So, you know, things have clearly changed. There are many more women. There are more people of color. But I would also say the pace of change is maddeningly slow. I mean, we used to have 10% of medical students were women. Now it's 50%, more than 50%. But women are not being hired anywhere near those numbers as faculty in medical schools. And you find the same thing in biology, parity at the undergraduate and graduate levels, but not parity at the assistant professor level. So we have, and physics, sorry, I didn't even mention physics and engineering are like way behind the life sciences. So we have a long way to go.
Kuhaley, you're nodding your head a lot.
It's very similar to the geosciences, where about 40% of the PhDs go to women, but at the full professor level, there's less than 10% women. So it's very similar to what Meg has just said about physics and engineering and, you know, the other sciences.
So it doesn't vary much by field.
Apparently not.
Cassidy, your research looks at things like how often men and women are cited in their research. Turns out it's kind of complicated, right?
Well, I think it shows and repeats some of the things that we've heard before, these invariant gender disparities regardless of discipline. Our studies have reconfirmed that men's voices matter more in science. They're more likely to be in leading roles, they produce more, and their work is more highly cited. Some of those complexities do come when we start to dig down into the places in which they're putting their work. So we find that women, particularly those in heavily male-dominated fields, engineering and other fields like this, tend to publish in more prestigious journals, that is, journals with higher journal impact factors. However, even when they place their work in these journals, their work receives fewer citations.
Has that been constant? That has not gone up or down at all?
You know, we're starting to see better equality in these, but as was mentioned earlier, the progress is very, very slow. And there are still skeptics who argue that this is due to some inherent differences in the content or quality of women's work. Yet recent studies have dispelled this myth. Modeling all the properties of articles and predicting citation rates, we find that these systematic biases still exist against work authored by women.
Mm-hmm. Kuhaley, when women want to go for another job and they need a letter of recommendation, are they getting
well,
those?
Well, that's the study that my co-authors and I, we just finished. And what we found, well, other fields such as medicine, psychology, chemistry, and biochemistry, they had already had these studies done on letters of recommendation, and there wasn't such a study for the geosciences. And so we did this. But what we found was that our results were very similar in that men were consistently, they received more of these outstanding letters, and women were much less likely to receive them. And when I say outstanding letters, I mean the ones that portray the applicant to be this top-notch scientist, this role model, this leader, this pioneer, this rising star. Those tend to go more to men than to women. And the other surprising thing that we found that the gender of the letter writer didn't seem to matter. Whether it was a male writing the letter or a female writing the letter, it was very similar. And also the sense is that some of these biases, I mean, it's probably more to do with widespread cultural stereotypes than any conscious intent to harm someone. But that's something, that's a challenge that women face. And this was, the other thing is that letters of recommendation is just one piece of this. Funding, publications, callback for interviews, race and gender. I mean, all of these, I mean, they've actually done studies on all of these things and found differences.
What? Yeah, if I could just add something. If you look at the major metrics that we consider when we're hiring someone or when we're trying to promote promote them or give them tenure, every single one of them has been shown to be biased by gender. So we heard about citations and letters of recommendation, funding and proposals. There are a number of astronomy studies that show that women have less chance of getting their proposals accepted. Whether people are invited speakers or win prizes, those are biased by gender. Teaching evaluations, even the status of the publications, as was mentioned earlier. So all these things that are how we measure excellence are systematically biased against women. And some of your listeners may wonder whether it's bias or the women just aren't as good. And most of these experiments do careful things to sort of check for that, and they don't find any measures of women not being as good. Indeed, to do as well in a review, they have to be many times better.
You're nodding again.
Yes, because, I mean, there are actually studies that specifically tested for bias and found exactly that. So when faculty were asked to rate applicants for a lab manager position, this is science faculty, they were given two identical applications. One had a male name and one had a female name. And both male and female faculty ended up rating the male applicant much higher, calling him more competent and more hireable. That was in one study. Mm. They did another study with CVs where they just changed the male name and a female name on the CV, and they got a very similar result. Same with funding. NIH did, they commissioned a study later for race, but prior to that, there was the study done that looked at funding, and they found that women received only about 60% or two-thirds of the funding that men received.
I'll throw this out to you. Let me ask Cassidy first. You would think that of all the professions in the world, whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, if you're a scientist, you depend on the facts, right? You should be listening more.
Right. We would hope that in all fields we shouldn't see the systematic discrimination against women in the knowledge economy, but we do, and we also see it in the distribution of labor roles. And I think a lot of it goes back to that when we see women working in science in different ways. So one of the studies that we looked at saw what people were doing in order to contribute to the authorship of a paper, and we found that men were more likely to be granted authorship for conceptual tasks, like designing or writing the study, whereas women are granted authorship for technical tasks. So in short, women were at the hands of science, but men were choosing which questions to ask, and I think that relates to a lot of these things, these letters of recommendation, these systematic biases, when women are perceived as a different kind of scientist doing different kinds of labor in science. So a lot of these discriminations are both implicit, but many explicit biases that still happen in the knowledge economy.
I also found it interesting that what you said, Kohaly, is that sometimes it's the women discriminating against women, too. Is that because it's just built in, or is it...
Yes, I mean, I think...
Is it
like
cultural over all this time?
Yes, I think it's sort of a widespread cultural stereotype rather than, any conscious negativity. But the other thing that was very interesting is that there was the study that said that this was not just limited to science. For example, there were fields like, the biological sciences and life sciences where you have more numbers of women in those fields. And then on the other hand, in the, you know, you have fields like philosophy, a non-scientific field, which is very, very male dominated. And so there was the study, and there, you know, there what they stated was that it wasn't necessarily about women or science. It was about whether there was a perception that you needed raw, innate talent to be successful in that field. And women were generally stereotyped as not having that sort of brilliance to be successful in that field. And it wasn't just women. They found African Americans as well were stereotyped as not being brilliant enough to be in those fields.
Mm-hmm. McGarry, you were on a committee approving proposals for time at the Hubble Space Telescope, and research has found that even that has been a process biased against women. And if you weren't aware, how could anyone be aware?
You know, exactly. I was running the proposal review when these biased results were happening. They were very small differences, and so they weren't visible in any one cycle. And the people at Space Telescope Science Institute, I applaud them for what they've done in looking at 25 years of review data. They could actually see a significant signal. It is very subtle, and we all do it. It's not men doing it to women or white people doing it to black people. We all have biases which are formed by the society we grew up in. And so, but I think in science, maybe the problem is just a little bit more stubborn, because objectivity is a core value for a scientist. As you said, you know, this is how we do our work, supposedly. And so people are very resistant to the idea that they're not objective. There's a lovely piece of research that I won't recite the whole thing for you, but basically the people who thought they were objective were the ones most liable to make a biased decision, to actually switch criteria in midstream to agree with the gender of applicants for a particular job. And it was only the people who said they were not objective, who were self-aware that they had some biases, who were able to behave in a more objective way. So I think we really have a problem here where we need to get people to understand they have biases that they don't even realize.
And women, as you pointed out, also aren't the only group working for representation in science. Can people of color, women of color, others all benefit about a conversation about women, Kahale?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, some of the research that, you know, shows that the challenges that women face in science, it's very similar for minorities, specifically underrepresented minorities in science. You know, they're up against these same challenges. And, you know, for example, you know, going back to the gender thing, following on Meg's point, there was a study where they showed that male faculty were very resistant to the idea. They were very skeptical that gender bias actually exists in science. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in a Pew Center study, they found that whites were much less likely to believe that there's racial inequity in society than blacks were. And there was an NIH study that NIH actually commissioned, and, you know, kudos to them for commissioning it and also making the results public, where they found that a black PhD scientist was far less likely to get funded than a white PhD scientist from a similar institution with a similar scientific record. So these biases run very deep. And like I mentioned about the earlier study where they thought that African Americans don't have that, you know, the sort of brilliance needed for these fields. And another issue is that, you know, following on this thing about people being very resistant to it, I mean, sometimes we hear, you know, when, you know, in searches, we hear comments like, let's not look at race or gender, let's just look at merit. And that is, I mean, not only does that show that this person really doesn't know much about how implicit bias works, but these sorts of comments also give rise to a very damaging perspective that there's a trade-off between diversity and excellence, so that if you're hiring a woman or a minority, you're somehow compromising on the quality and the standards that you would expect in science.
We're talking about discrimination in science, and especially women minorities, at this hour on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And talking with Cassidy Tsujimoto, Kahale Dutt, and Meg Urey. In the few minutes that we have left, is there any optimism among my panel here about getting better? Cassidy, let me Meg, I'll go around the table, my non-table.
Sure.
Here.
I mean,
I believe in optimism. I think now is a particularly a time for optimism, and it's true we've seen advances in gender equity in both production and impact and on a lot of these variables we've talked about. However, modeling our current rates of production and impact, it will still be decades before we reach parity. And frankly, as a mother of two daughters, I'm not content to wait that long. I believe we need to do more to sort of reduce this overwhelming skepticism about the bias, to train people, have conversations about implicit bias, to look critically about how we run our labs and distribute our labor. And I think we need to continue to do research that brings light to these disparities, whether it's about gender, race, social class, citizenship, or other variables that impede our progress in terms of a healthy scientific system.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to add?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So, for example, at Lamont Doherty at Columbia, where I work, about 8 to 10 years ago, at the junior ranks, and I mean like at the assistant research professor ranks, we had less than 18% women. And now that figure is somewhere between 40 and 45% women. And that is a result of very conscious institutional efforts to address the problem. The issue is very different with underrepresented minorities because when you take African-Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans together, they account for about 5% of the PhDs in the geosciences. So that's a different problem there. But yes, I definitely think that there has been progress. And more institutions are now becoming aware of the need to do something mm-hmm. and taking steps to do it.
Yeah, I've seen the same. I have to say, we see more talk about implicit bias. People are aware of what it means, and I've seen changes in department meetings and in the conversations in the hall. So I think it's going forward. You know, we really have to get this right because so many of the challenges facing the nation in the next right. decade or two are technical and scientific.
Where's the conversation not happening where it should be happening? If it's happening in the halls and with your colleagues, where is it not happening? I mean, you think it's happening in all the places it should be?
Well, I think it's still a minority. I think yeah. there's still quite a few skeptics who don't believe there's anything wrong. You know, frankly, American science is extraordinarily successful. We typically get a couple Nobel Prizes every season, and, we have amazing discoveries that have fueled our economy. So people look at that and say it's as good as it could possibly be. And what I hope people are thinking about is the people you haven't tapped, in your profession, the white men are a shrinking fraction of the pie in this country. And if we're not tapping all the talent that's out there, we're not doing as well as we could. This is, exactly the point Kohele was making, but let me make it explicit that excellence and diversity are aligned. If we don't get it right, we are not as good as we can be.
Well, that's a good place to end it. Let me thank all of you for a stimulating conversation. Cassie Sugimoto, Associate Professor of Informatics at Indiana University in Bloomington. Kohele Dutt is Assistant Director of Academic Affairs and Diversity at Columbia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and co-author of Women in the Geosciences. Meg Urey, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Yale and past President of the American Astronomical Society. Thank you all for this great conversation.
Thank you so much for bringing attention to it.
Have a happy holiday to all of you. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the great City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week on our holiday show. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.